This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. At participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
Every sip of Coca-Cola brings you closer to the excitement of the FIFA World Cup 26. Because nothing compares to the joy. So grab a Coke and drink in the FIFA World Cup 26. No purchase necessary. 13 plus in 50 U.S. states and D.C. with a web-enabled device. Ends March 1st with 8 entry periods. Rules at CokeURL.com/soccer rules.
This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Hey everyone, Logan Medish of High Caliber History and the host of the No Low Ballers podcast here. If you're passionate about firearms, accessories, and everything in between, there's one place you need to check out, GunBroker.com. Whether you're looking to buy, sell, or just browse, GunBroker is the world's largest online marketplace for firearms, ammunition, and all the gear that you need. It's a trusted platform that connects buyers and sellers across the U.S., offering everything from rare and collectible firearms to the latest models. Plus, with a wide range of accessories, parts, and ammo, GunBroker.com is a one-stop shop for gun enthusiasts of all kinds. So whether you're an experienced gun owner or you're just getting started, make sure to visit GunBroker.com to find exactly what you're looking for. And don't forget, you can also tune in to our No Low Ballers podcast to hear more about the history behind your favorite firearms, sponsored by GunBroker.com. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish of High Caliber History. As always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Alan Faulkner from Gunbroker. And in one of our previous episodes, I had told you guys that I felt like I was being ganged up on because we had two different guys from Gunbroker on here and I was the odd man out. But Alan, now we're both feeling a little ganged up on because we've got two special guests from SIG today. We have Tom Taylor, who's the Executive Vice President of Global Brand Development, and we have Dave Grimshaw, who recently retired and has come back to SIG as the R&D Technical Advisor, because the gun industry is like the mafia. You never get out. Dave, Tom, welcome
so good
to the
show.
Yeah, same here.
And Logan, I got bad news for you, but we're not ganged up. This is my fire team, man. These are my boys. Y'all are the one on the odd man out right now.
Yeah, you we got you, Alan.
Oh, man. I don't think it's going to work. You know, they used to say you could duck under the table to avoid nuclear fallout, because apparently nuclear fallout just kind of goes around a table when you duck under it. So if you guys launch some tactical nukes on me, I guess I'll hide under my desk and hope it doesn't.
You have no idea what we're capable of here at SIG.
Oh, goodness. Well, gentlemen, we're here because SIG is celebrating an anniversary, a 40th anniversary, and of course we are talking about the P226 that turns 40 years old this year, an absolute icon of a handgun for SIG. So, you know, I don't know, Dave, Tom, whichever one of you, do you want to kind of kick us off and talk a little bit about the development of that platform?
I mean, I'll back up a step if that's okay. And because I speak to a lot of groups and so many people don't even know the history of SIG. And so the 40 years of the 226 is amazing, but not a lot of people know that J.B. Sauer's son was founded in 1751. In Germany, and SIG, a Swiss industrial group, was founded in 1853 as a wagon wheel company, and then in 1859 bid on the Swiss Army contract, and the rest is history there. So SIG and Sauer didn't come together officially until 1975 to collaborate on handguns, which was the classic line which led to the 226. So just that's the super fast, you know, 300 whatever year history to get to that point. But yeah, I think I'll let Dave take over in terms of the birth of the 226 a little bit, because, you know, he's been around a lot longer than I have, and I've been here 10 years. But I think he's seen it from a lot of different angles, and I'll jump in as necessary with some of the military pedigree and whatever he doesn't cover, we can jump back and forth.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Well, back in the day, the Army started looking for a new pistol to replace in 1911, and the 226 was going to be our entry into that competition. Basically, it derived from the 220. It needed to be double stack, so here was the birth of the 226. Had a lot of the same features, a lot of the same safety features, which was a big thing. And obviously, it was 9mm. And it's gone through a lot of changes since then, as you know, things progress. But, you know, it's kind of the workhorse of SIG, of the classic line. When it did go into the entry for the XM9 pistol trials, I think the only test that didn't pass was dry mud. We passed everything else with flying colors, and then basically it boiled down to cost.
Dry mud just seems like an odd oxymoron a little bit.
But, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's a long way to say dirt.
Dust or
well, as we know, there is a very specific compound known as NATO mud.
NATO mud.
So I suppose dry mud might as well.
Yeah. I think it was unfortunate because, you know, by all measures, it was the gun that won the competition, if you will. But it was expensive. And then, obviously, a couple years later, I think its legacy was sealed when the dev group selected the gun and it became the MK25, or you know, that was how that was labeled in the military vernacular. And so, you know, it was on the hips of Navy SEALs for the next 20 years, and that's launched SIG into a lot of really cool friendships and partnerships with those who served in the SEAL teams for all those years. And I think it was pretty interesting how that evolved into that.
Dev Grew, never heard of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the big evolution of this gun, though, was, you know, toward the late 80s, a lot of municipal police departments were looking to get away from revolvers. I know one agency that I worked for, we wound up going to 226s, and a lot of West Coast PDs went to 226s at the time. So the new gun for LE at the time. You know, it was basically a double stack 225 in reality. You know, it had the decocker, which was great for the, you know, for law enforcement. And again, you know, it was a good pistol for armorers to maintain. And, you know, it was just a beast. It was really the perfect pistol to replace a revolver with.
Well, I was thinking that the double action, single action function had to be a familiar feel to a revolver shooter, but, you know, kind of on that first trigger pull, but then kind of getting them into the single action feel after that. Excuse me. That had to, you know, again, feel familiar up front, but kind of evolve them into, you know, the future of, you know, what semi-auto pistol triggers kind of became.
Yeah, no, at one time, you know, when I first started up here, I was still adjuncting for the academy. I started doing that back in the 90s. I think I was still on active duty. And, you know, George Harris had a rack of pistols, 226 being one of them, a few other ones, and periodically we would grab somebody out of a class and we would run them through a drill to see how they reacted to that double action to single action, to see, you know, all right, where were they throwing rounds at? And it was pretty impressive to see exactly, you know, where they were having trouble. It wasn't where you thought it was. You know, the double action was perfect because, you know, they're concentrating on what they're doing and they get into that single action, and that's where we had to slow them down and get them back into, you know, shooting a good tight group. So it was a pretty cool little exercise.
That's neat. You know, and I think it's important to note that, you know, it really wasn't up until the absolute last moment when the Army made their decision that anyone really knew how things were going to go. Because I was rereading an article in one of the gun mags, might have been American Handgunner, from December of 1983. And the last line in that article was something to the effect of, but who knows, the 1911 may be around for another 70 years. Because they just weren't sure which way things were going to go. And of course, they were even talking about just retooling the 1911 A1 and just keeping those guns going. So it was not a foregone conclusion as to who was going to get that contract or if the contract was even going to come through at all.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of perspective because I've been inside the building at SIG. And I've been inside the building for 5 years. My first job in the industry 20 years ago was at Smith & Wesson. And, you know, the way the competition went was the SIG 226, the Smith & Wesson, I think it was a 5906 Smith & Wesson, and then the Beretta. And, you know, just to be, you know, just to say what I've heard over the years, that in the order of finish in terms of the actual competition outside of price, the SIG, the Smith, and the Beretta was the finishing order. And so it came down to price. There was also... inside the industry and inside the buildings, there was, you know, word that SIG was notified they had won at one point. To your point, Logan, about how I think it was just evolving and it was moving. It was a moving target. Was it going to stay in 1911? Was it going to be the SIG, the Smith, or the Beretta, and so on? And so there was word that SIG had been notified they won, and then it was put on pause. And then a few weeks went by, and then Beretta was ultimately announced as the winner. What was interesting about that, and I've never in all the years, with 5 years at one of the companies and 10 years at another, I've never been able to get a confirmation of this, but after Beretta won that contract, shortly after that, there was an announcement made that there was a parcel of land in southern Italy that was given to the United States government to build an air base. And so, you know, unlikely our government would ever support a gun company in that way. But is it possible that the Italian government helped Beretta win that contract by what could be a more strategic parcel of land than an air base in southern Italy? And so, you know, you never know. You'll never know. We never know how these things go. But it would have been interesting to be around in those days to understand like how that all went down. But yeah, it's you know, it certainly made the Beretta 92 M9, you know, a legendary gun. I don't think it ever had It never developed much of a reputation because I don't think handguns were viewed the same way back then they are now. It was purely last ditch backup. You know, it wasn't viewed the same way. Guns today, handguns today, you know, and fast forward to the P320, you know, winning the MHS contract. The accuracy standard for that gun is unbelievable. The Beretta M9 standard was a 9x11 inch rectangle. So essentially the standard for 10 rounds at 25 yards was a 9x11 inch rectangle. The standard for the P320 or the M17 M18 was 2.85 inches at 25 yards with 10 rounds. You know, that's not something a human being can shoot. You know, that had to be tested out of a fixture to be able to hold that standard. And so, you know, the Beretta was just chosen as a workhorse, but I think the way the military looks at it now, it truly needs to be part of your battle, you know, sort of process, if you will. So it's viewed very differently. The 226, on the other hand, just one more thing. I mean, the other thing, and probably the reason the SEALs went that direction is because they, even in those days, they did view it as a battle weapon. And so, you know, they needed something that could do what they needed it to do. And, you know, with all due respect, I'm not sure the Beretta could do what they needed it to do versus the 226. So, sorry, go ahead.
No, you're good. Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, there, even though the shooting accuracy standard, you know, was considerably larger for the Beretta than it was for what became the M17, I think it's interesting to look at, you know, how the criteria for choosing these guns has changed over the years. I mean, because it was not an easy process, even back in the 80s, to get that contract, to meet all of the requirements. I think there was something like 72 requirements that had to be met. And so, I mean, you know, the guys at SIG, they were really having to dot their I's and cross their T's to make sure they had everything covered that the military was wanting out of this gun.
One thing that I appreciate changing, you know, I'm all for the government trying to save taxpayer money, but for, you know, a lot of years, that savings came at the expense of equipment for service personnel. So like we said, we have a product that, you know, kind of clearly was the better choice from an end user perspective, but you know what, let's save a few bucks and go with this one that, you know, maybe finish second, maybe finish third, you know, whatever. You know, we're now, at least, you know, from the contracts I've seen over the last decade or so, cost is certainly a consideration, but it doesn't seem to be the only consideration anymore. And I mean, that to me, I'm fine paying taxpayer dollars if it keeps our armed forces a little bit safer and a little more secure and better armed.
Yeah. And we saw that with the modular handgun system because, you know, we, as our competitor loudly proclaimed, we were the lower price point. What they didn't proclaim was that out of the nine major testing areas, which broke down into many other areas, as you said, I think it was 27. It wasn't 72 that I know of, but it was 27. Dave might know more about that than I do, but I believe there are 27 testing criteria broken into nine areas. And, you know, our score and the reason the competition ended a year early is because we won five categories, tied three, and lost one. The only area that the 320 lost was soldier preference. At that time, the P320 was barely 2 years old, and the Glock has been around for forever. And so, so you know, it was being here when that was going on, and Dave was deeper into it than I was. It's an otherworldly test, you know, to survive what those guns have to go through to win those contracts. And so, you know, the workhorse that the 226 was back in those days, and maybe there was 72 criteria, but 72 points that it had to pass. But yeah, we know what that gun is today. You know, it's you know, I think when a gun reaches legendary status, it says something about the gun, and I don't think anybody would argue that the 226 is absolutely legendary.
Most definitely. And, you know, Dave, can you talk to a little bit of some of the criteria that
as
the guns had to
meet? As far as the 226?
Yes,
well,
sir.
Yeah, obviously accuracy was one of them. You know, maintainability, that seems to be, that's a big thing lately, you know, serviceability. How much is it going to cost us to maintain these guns? And, you know, back into the, you know, the classic lines, you know, they pretty much run forever. You know, there's been a lot of changes throughout the years. You know, we went from the firing pin retaining pins were two coil pins driven into each other. We went to a single pin. So, you know, not a lot of major changes to it. But, you know, again, things that made the gun a little bit better for servicing and just, you know, kept the thing running forever. You know, some of the reasons, like, you know, why would the SEALs pick a 226 over a Beretta? Well, you got to look at the gun itself. You know, the barrel's exposed on the Beretta. You know, the barrel's encapsulated in a slide on a 226. It's more resistant to, you know, salt water, things of that nature. So, you know, there was a lot of things that, you know, they looked at when they went to that. Accuracy was big. I remember back in the day when the 226 was becoming popular, when I was an instructor at the AMU, was assigned MTU1. We did an accuracy test with a accurized M9 from the AMU against a 220 and a 226, and the 226 just outshot it accuracy wise, and we were shooting those at 50 meters, not 25. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it's and it wasn't just like it was a little better; it was a lot better.
So if someone goes out, you know, and purchases a brand new 226, you know, I know you mentioned some of the pins, you know, are a little different, but what are, you know, are there visual differences that people will notice between the guns that came out 40 years ago and the one that you can buy?
Oh,
off
yeah.
The shelf
so
today?
One of the first things you would notice would be the extractor. You know, we have external extractors now. Back in the day, they were internal extractors sitting inside the slide. The slides were stamped steel, whereas now they're machined. You know, the spring boxes were welded on. That those had locking inserts fitted into them, or breech blocks, rather, excuse me. So, yeah, the extractors kind of look like a 1911 spring-loaded extractor up inside the slide, whereas now they're external. Other than that, not too many visual changes.
The rail.
Really. Yeah, well, obviously, yeah, rail. You know, the old guns, like the Commemorative we just did, you know, didn't have a rail. There's been a lot of changes. Like, I remember somebody mentioned to me, I was showing them one of the older manuals when we were looking to do the 40th anniversary gun. You know, I was managing the technical writing guys, and I said, hey, you know, we're going to give them an older style yellow box with the red felt in it for this Commemorative gun. We can't just throw in a commercial classic line manual. You know, let's give them something old school. So back before Sauer AG had kind of shut down, I got with one of my guys over there and did a big data dump of anything that had technical, and literally got all the files of all the drawings for the manuals. And what I mean by that is, back then, they didn't use CAD. Everything was hand-drawn. So all the images in the older German manuals were hand-drawn. And what they did to make them be manipulative is they would, you know, draw them in segments and then just do, like, paste overlays to show the slide coming back. Well, we had all those. So in the manual you get for your new 40th anniversary gun, all the images in there are the old German hand-drawn images. A lot of people don't know that. You know, probably should have had marketing put that out on the website, because it's unique. You know, it's a unique feature. Yeah,
that is
and
unique.
So you know, it's just something to make the thing a little bit more collectible. But yeah, it was. I still have some of the files of some of the older, you know, engineering drawings that were done back, you know, between Germany and Switzerland, because there was, you know, everybody was working on that gun. It wasn't just one part of the company.
The thing I've always respected right. about SIG, and I think, you know, is really reflected in the 226, we talk about 40 years of changes. It seems like the changes that SIG implements kind of come one of two ways. Either we've improved a manufacturing technique, either through machinery or just skill and trial and use, or we've gotten feedback from the end users, the actual hard users of these products, and we implement those changes into the product. That's largely what I see reflected in the 226, either just, you know, the improved way to machine something so that it's more durable, faster, stronger, lighter, less expensive, or, you know, the guys who use these in the field say, we would like it if it did X or Y, and SIG's always been very receptive to that.
Yeah, you know, the newer frames with the beaver tail, you know, that was a big feature, so that's an obvious, you know, visual change. But, you know, realistically, if you look at a gun that's that old, there really hasn't been that many changes to it, you know?
I mean, if you get it right the first time, you know.
Yeah, that gun is unique that way. While there's been changes to improve it, they've been subtle. But another thing that, you know, to your point, Alan, is not just with the 20 years of the Ron Cohen, you know, era at Sig Sauer, but even prior to that with Germany. I'll back the story up, but we get a lot of criticism, you know, from consumers because, you know, this generation of this pistol or rifle doesn't, you know, it's not fully backwards compatible with the next generation and the next generation. And, you know, we get criticized for that a fair amount. And, you know, I've talked to Ron Cohen, our CEO, about it a lot. And, you know, he is pretty clear that if we can make a product better, we are going to make it better. If that means that product is not backwards compatible with the version before it, then so be it. We, you know, why would we stick with, I think our industry is bad about saying, yeah, I don't really want to mess with it, you know, but Sig has a very different way of looking at it. You know, we're going to take a gun and if we can make it better, we're going to make it better. And he uses the example of, you know, when a consumer complains about, well, this part that you make now doesn't fit back on the gun that I bought 10 years ago. Would you buy a car from 1 year to the next without understanding that you might have to, you know, it might not have the same parts compatible from 1 year to the next? And so, you know, Sig will always be about continuous improvement. And, you know, our tagline, never settle, you know, it that's where that came from. Listening to Ron Cohen talk to groups and different people, and he would say, we'll never settle for our gun being finished or being perfect or being good. And we're gonna, if we can strive for perfection and always make it better, we're going to do that. And so I think it's just an interesting point. And maybe it's part of the legacy of the 226. You can look at it and see how subtle the changes are, because it was definitely, you know, from the day it was launched back in the mid 80s, 1984, you know, the changes have been super subtle.
You know, and talking about, you know, making changes and moving forward, I think that's a good tie-in for us to kind of talk about the Legion series of the guns. And, you know, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what the Legion series is and how it differs from the other guns in the 226 lineup and all of the other firearms that you can find in the Legion series?
Yeah, I mean, and Dave will probably have some perspective on this as well. As I had just gotten to Sig when the Legion series was being contemplated. Some of the naming wasn't quite finalized and the guns weren't quite finalized, but it was very interesting because by that time in 2015, semi-automatic hammer, you know, double DASA pistols were really, you know, really sort of shrinking, if you will. Striker pistols were taking over the world or already had taken over the world. And, you know, the classic line of Sig was beginning to shrink as people converted to striker fired guns. And so our product manager at the time, who Dave knows very well, Tim Butler, was the product manager at Sig. Now we have product managers across every category here. We have a number of product managers, but he was the guy. And Tim, you know, worked on that project. And when we do a product like that, we have to sign up for some volume amount. We have to tell our CEO, okay, I'm going to spend all this time and money on development, and then we think it's going to sell X, Y, and Z. So the funny side story about those two guns, the 226 and the 229 Legion products that were launched in 2015, the volume forecast from our product manager was 3,000 to 5,000 guns, that within the next year we'd sell 3,000 to 5,000, which for a gun that costs what that gun costs and had all the feature changes, you know, that we thought that was actually 5,000 guns would have been a huge success. What I can tell you, you know, in terms of that 226 and 229, which were launched together, over the next 18 months, the company sold 70,000 of those two guns.
Holy moly.
That doesn't
shock
me. I mean, this is absolutely one of my favorite carry guns going, the 226 Legion SAO. For me, this is the pinnacle of the 226 design. I mean, it's a fantastic trigger. You got the Gray Guns trigger in there, the finish. And really, this is where Sig takes that user input and brings it right into it. I mean, you guys looked at what users, be it special forces, be it law enforcement, be it high volume shooters, were doing to their guns. You know, what modifications were they making to make the gun better? And you brought that into the Legion line. I mean, it could have been a simple marketing thing. Hey, we're going to give it its own color and put a neat little logo on top of it and call it a day. But You guys didn't do that. I mean, SIG did the legwork, and they brought the things that people wanted into these guns.
Now, there were 15 individual changes to that gun when we sent the brochure out. It had arrows pointing to all the, you know, all that was done to the gun. There were 15 changes, you know, of course, with the color being one of them. But, you know, one thing the Legion line has always been is like, now that we've done it across a number of guns and other versions of 226s from the original, Ron never wants to launch a gun that doesn't have something unique. I mean, it's just, you know, whether it's P365 and capacity or the 320 and modularity, the MCX and its modularity and uniqueness to a standard AR rifle or whatever it was, you know, we just kind of refused to compromise and launch something that's just sort of a me too product. And so I think what manifested itself with the 226 for all those years, at that time, 30 years of heritage, all those loyal 226 folks, whether you were a Navy SEAL, a cop, a gun lover or whatever, they saw this gun that took all those great things and put it into one gun and also made it a unique color. And there was a club you could join and unique, you know, knives and Legion merchandise you could buy. And that's why I think 70,000 people came back to the cash register and bought those guns. It was just it was something, you know, sometimes in business, you're really, really good at what you do. And sometimes, I don't know if I want to call it luck, but sometimes you just land on the right idea. And I think the Legion series, you know, and starting with the 226 and the 229 were just one of those ideas that everybody that loved the 226 said, wow, this has everything I ever wanted. And they came back to the table and they bought another one. So, but I imagine Dave was involved in some of those conversations back then with Tim on, you know, what some of the features were, but no, it was a pretty, it's just one of those projects that really resonated with our customers, and that comes from listening to customers and doing things the right way.
Yeah, 70,000 sales versus your 5,000 projected. I know you didn't intend it this way, but way to underpromise and overdeliver, guys.
We like to do that.
Hey, everyone. Alan Forkner from the No Low Ballers podcast here, and I'm talking to all the collectors and firearms enthusiasts out there. If you're on the hunt for exclusive high-end firearms, then look no further than CollectorsEliteAuctions.com. This is the premier auction site for serious collectors who are looking to find rare and collectible firearms, accessories, and memorabilia. At Collectors Elite Auctions, every auction is carefully curated, featuring some of the most sought-after pieces in the country. Whether you're looking to expand your collection or find that one unique item, this is where top-tier firearms meet serious bidders. And with easy-to-use online bidding, it's never been simpler to add items to your collection. So if you're ready to take your collection to the next level, or get started collecting, visit CollectorsEliteAuctions.com and start bidding today. Oh, and don't forget to listen to the No Low Ballers podcast, where we dive into the history of firearms and the stories behind some of these incredible pieces. Brought to you by GunBroker.com. A story that not a lot of people might know, when they introduced the Legion, I remember there were a lot of questions early on about, well, when do we get a 320 Legion? When do we get an MCX Legion? When do we get an MPX Legion? And again, SIG could have treated it as a marketing program and said, next quarter. Their answer, though, was, we can't do a Legion for those guns yet. They haven't been out long enough. We don't have enough user input. People haven't tested them to their extreme limits yet. Until the sharp end of the spear guys beat these up and actually figure out what they want, there's no point in us doing a Legion. So again, they held the line on that and made sure that anything bearing the Legion was really reflective of what the people who use them for a living and, you know, a livelihood, what they wanted and what they needed in a gun. And that's shockingly rare.
Yeah, because I think a different company might have recognized that immediate success and rushed to have Legion products on everything we could as fast as we could. I mean, one of the visions that I've had that we never really closed on was, you know, I envision having a catalog of Legion guns with every gun SIG makes. Well, we haven't done that because we haven't found the right formula for every gun to make it a Legion gun. And we will. We ultimately will do that. A 1911 is one that the Legion world has been asking for a long time. But, you know, we haven't found the right combination of stuff that hasn't already been done either by SIG or a lot of other people. So we're kind of waiting on that one. But the only guns that, you know, and I like to be honest and I like to be, you know, try to open up. And that's why we do these podcasts, is to give a little bit of the inside baseball. But to be honest with you, even though commercially we sold quite a few because it was a highly demanded gun, but I would say the least successful Legion product that we had was our 238 and our 938. And I believe the reason that those weren't as successful as the others is because there wasn't much that we could do to them. And it, you know, it, like I said, we sold a bunch of them commercially because people love to collect the Legion and all that kind of stuff. But it was definitely the least demanded one that we did. And I think it speaks to the fact that we made the right decision to not to rush to do a 1911 because we didn't know exactly what we wanted to do to make it a Legion. And that manifested itself in the 238 and the 938.
That makes sense. I mean, you've got guys like the British SAS and, you know, Navy Special Warfare beating these guns up. Their input's going to be pretty rich and pretty meaningful where, you know, 238s and 938s, I have them both. I've carried them both. I like them both. But, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, they're probably not getting quite the same level of infield testing as a 226 has.
No, and there's simply not as much stuff you can do to a gun that those kinds of guns in the 1911 family or the Micro 1911 that hasn't already been done. And so, like I said, Ron is pretty, Dave's worked for him a lot longer than I have, but when he gets a philosophy in his head, it's pretty hard to break that idea and the concept that we're not going to compromise and just, you know, slap a marketing spin on something and call it, you know, a cool gun. You know, that's not the way we looked at Legion. You know, we've certainly done marketing spins on guns. We know we've done that with certain things, but the Legion series, we wanted to keep it really pure in terms of truly, you know, the tip of the spear in terms of the best that we can put out.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's the uniqueness of the features that went into that gun that, you know, made the demand so high. Just like Tom was saying, you know, what can you do to a 238 and a 938? I mean, back in the day, at one time, we had one product manager, Eric Von Bossi. He handled everything. And one night, I got a call from Ron. He asked me, would you like to be the rifle manager? And I said, oh, I appreciate it, but no. He said, no, you don't understand, I'm not asking you. So the next day in his office, he goes, okay, I want 10 new products from each of you every month. And I'm like, okay, you know, 10 new rifles, you know, Eric was like, oh, I'm just going to put different colored grips on these things. You know, so it gets back to, you know, what did we do to the 226 Legion to make it that much bigger? Like what you said, Alan, you know, you pick it up and you look at it, or you throw it in your hand, you're like, holy smokes, you know, this thing's incredible. It's that much different than a standard gun. And that's why it does so well as a Legion gun. You know, down the road, will we do a Legion MCX? Maybe, maybe not. There might not be enough, you know, spunk to put to that thing to make it like the pistol. You know, what more can you do to it? So, you know, that's how the Legion brand got, you know, was pretty much born. You know, Tim Butler said, all right, what are we going to do to this thing that we don't do to anything else? And, you know, what's going to make it sell? Where's the appeal? You know, what would you want done to it? So, you know, that's how that kind of evolved. Yeah. It's got to be one of those things where you pick it up and look at it, and there's no question in your mind, like, I'm buying this gun.
Well, it's just funny how the yeah. Legion series has come full circle, because that, you know, the 226 and the 229 back in 2015 launched this into an amazing program. To date, right now, we sit here with 180,000 Legion members. And you can't just join, as you guys know, you can't just join the Legion. You got to buy the gun to be able to go on and put your serial number in and join the club, so to speak. Over 15% of Legion owners own more than one. I can't even tell you how many people have bought every one. It's a good number. We have something about 3 a year. We have something called Camp Legion, where Legion members, quite honestly, give us a lot of money to come to SIG and spend a week with us here. They tour the factory, they meet Ron Cohen, they spend 2.5 days at SIG Academy shooting. They, you know, we have nice restaurants here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire area, historic town and everything. And so in the last 2 years, we have a camp for 40 people plus a guest, so 80, up to 80 people. Some people might come alone. This year we had two Camp Legions, and we had a Camp Legion alumni for people who had already been, who wanted to come back and give us a lot more money. this year, those three camps sold out in 7 minutes.
Wow.
And you know, holy it cow. Costs over $5,000 to come to a Camp Legion. And the year before, we weren't quite as successful. We had three camps, two regular Camp Legions and a Camp Legion alumni event, and they sold out in 13 minutes. So six Camp Legions at that cost over 2 years. One sold out in 13 minutes, one sold out in 7 minutes. And now we're having to contemplate what else do we do for our Legion members, because they're so hungry to be part of that whole phenomenon that became Legion. But my point is, it started with the 226 and 229, which were just such legacy products for SIG. And then it's interesting for me personally, because I've shot and I've loved a lot of Legion guns, but now our modern sort of bell cow of SIG products is the P365. And my favorite gun I've ever owned, ever shot in terms of being a sort of all purpose, do everything gun, is the P365 AXG Legion. And when you pick that gun, if you ever want to know why a gun is a Legion gun, to me, it feels like a mini 229 or something, but the shootability with the compensator, the metal grip, that's become my favorite gun I've ever touched. And, so being able to find those, and I'm not the only, there's a lot of people that feel the same way about the 365 AXG Legion. It just has really resonated with people, because you immediately touch that little gun with a metal frame, and then you go shoot it and you understand why it's so special. But we've always been able to figure out ways to capture some sort of magic, sort of a little bit of magic potion on the Legion products.
I've been aware of the Legion line since it came out, but I must admit, I don't own any of the Legion guns. But after hearing so much more about it and the backstory and stuff, I'm feeling left out of the club. So I think I'm going to have to go on Gunbroker and pick one up.
I told you were outnumbered, buddy. You just didn't know it.
I know, yeah. I mean, I do have a 365 sitting next to me on the desk here, but I do own SIG products, and as Alan can attest, in one of the earliest episodes we did, I actually have one of the surplus M17s over on the shelf here, but I'm not a member of the Legion family, so
you got to fix that. And then you got to come to a Camp Legion, maybe.
So I don't have Camp Legion money. But one day you got to aspire to things, right? Yeah. So, because this is a gun show and this is a history show, I know up there at HQ, you guys also have a bit of a SIG museum. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the stuff that's on display in there?
Oh, I can probably do that. Yeah. So when we built the SEC, we went ahead and built a museum in the
building.
That's
the SIG Experience Center at the Academy for anybody listening.
And, I kind of wish I was on the panel that helped design that thing, because we've already outgrown it. One of the other jobs that I've been tasked with is helping with the displays in there. So what you'll see when you go to the SEC in the museum, obviously, we have like a contract wall of most of the DOD government stuff that we won. So, you see a Rattler, LVAW, all the MCX, Rattler, PDW stuff that we did, and obviously the next-gen guns. And there's one historical wall that takes you through, like Tom was saying, back in the day when SIG first started, from, when you see the term they build wagons, we run a little deal every quarter in R&D. We do SIG Jeopardy. We actually bought the Jeopardy program and actually do a Jeopardy board. And one of the questions had to do with the wagons. And everybody thinks it's, wagon wheels and this and that. But actually what it is like VIP train cars. When you hear the word wagon, that's what they're building. And so you see that historic timeline from when they started building those items, throughout the progression of into the firearms. So, and unfortunately... Tom and I are always talking about this. We should have started thinking about having a historian early on, because we've lost and probably crushed and destroyed so much stuff that really is historical, and it's a shame. When I set up displays in there, my baseline for doing that is I look at it like, if you don't come here, you're not going to see this. And so that's how I set the displays up. The first one I put in there, aside for the stuff that's on the wall, was the Swiss rifles. And again, people don't realize, what SIG made rifle-wise back in the day for the Swiss Army and things of that nature. So there's a historical wall. There's a wall that has displays of our SIG shooting team with Max Michelle's guns, Daniel Horner's guns, Lena's guns. And we have a Hollywood wall, which we rotate out right now. Luckily, it's 226. It's not because it was the anniversary. It was the easiest one to do first. You know, we picked, we looked at how many movies have had a 226 in it, and the list was huge. So we have a few pistols on display, and then on the monitor, we're running clips from all those movies. And people stand there looking like, I didn't realize that was a 226. You know, so it's kind of cool. You know, that's what they come to see. And then we have two standalone displays. Right now, there's two. The biggest of the two is an MHS display. So it basically has stuff, again, that you would not see unless you went to the museum. There's the initial contract. There's a signed letter from Ron, the letter from the government. There's number one of each gun, and it's not just the gun. It's just the FCU, the fire control. We had to keep those per the contract, so we had to keep the first one of each. So those are on display. Some photographs, you know, as packed and shipped to the government. So it's a lot of stuff in a big display that, again, you wouldn't see unless you came there. And then the smaller display, we have the, Alan might remember these, the Von Bank collection, which is a collection of all the classic line guns. They all have the same numeric serial number. The prefix is different. And so those are on display. What we're working on right now is I'm working on a Medal of Honor display that's going in there. So stay tuned for that, because I don't want to give too much away, but the story behind it's unique. We were in the process of building 30-some-odd commemorative Medal of Honor pistols for all the remaining recipients that were alive. And Adam Young's building them for us back out in Special Weapons. And he came to me and says, hey, I'm going to have like a couple of extras of each with nobody's name on them. You know, why don't we throw them in the display and so people can see what the Medal of Honor pistols look like. And they're high-end, high-polished, you know, 320s. They look similar to the guns we built for the Sentinel Guards at Arlington. And in the midst of all this, one of the recipients passed away. And Adam came to me and he said, hey, you know, what are we going to do with his gun? And I said, well, we'd probably, you know, give it to the family and all that. So we got to doing some research on it. And I'll give you the condensed version of this. It's basically for a Cobra pilot that flew in to a hot LZ and extracted a four-man reconnaissance team. These guys clung on to the Cobra, and he flew them out of there. There's a whole lot more to this story, but that's it in a nutshell. So we're going to have a display for that. One of the recon guys is still alive. I talk to him almost on a daily basis now, trying to get this set up. The assistant pilot and gunner is still alive. Everybody else is since passed away. So at least there's two people that have been right there, can tell the story. So we're going to have an event, and once we open that display up in for the public to come see. So it's pretty cool. So yeah, so you know,
the only thing is there's a military diorama in the corner with a razor and four mannequins that have all, you know, SF uniforms on. They all have, you know, if you think about a soldier today, they've got a SIG handgun, a SIG rifle, a SIG machine gun, SIG ammunition, SIG optics, SIG suppressors, and, you know, they are wearing SIG underwear.
Legion underwear?
Well, Logan doesn't get any SIG Legion underwear, so I didn't want to offend him. But so there's this diorama that looks like it's in the desert with a razor and everything on there. And so, there's a little bit of everything there. There's another TV screen on one end of the museum that you can take a virtual tour of our facilities, because that's one of the things that we get requested all the time is that, can I get a tour of SIG facilities? Because we have all the gun facilities in New Hampshire, the ammunition facilities in Arkansas. We just opened a 250,000 square foot building that'll build all the U.S. military next generation ammunition. Then all of our optics facilities are out in Oregon. So because it's not feasible, we have a sort of a virtual tour that you can take inside the museum on a TV screen through all of our factories. So, and then beside that, we took different pieces of technology out of those factories, and we said, okay, how's a bullet made? You know, and showed it from raw brass all the way to a finished bullet. You know, how's a Romeo One Pro pistol optic made? And we showed the progression of how that's made and so on. So, there's a little bit of everything, and Dave's right.
You know, when during COVID, we actually designed the SIG Experience Center, and it's about a 40,000 square foot building. And almost the day we opened it, we realized it wasn't big enough. The museum wasn't nearly big enough. And so it's just something that we hope we can someday figure out how to expand. The other cool thing, just sidebar from that museum, is over in our facility in Switzerland, which is called 6 Hour AG. It's not open to the public, although we're hoping to remedy that. You want to talk about the richest history of 6 Hour products on the planet. That museum that's been set up for private showings and so forth, and essentially in the basement of one of our buildings in Switzerland. If you're a real gun lover and you go all the way back to the original SIG rifles, the muskets, it'll touch your heart essentially to go through that. And yeah, it's run by a bunch of old engineers with Eddie. It goes all the way back to the design of the P210 or P49 at the time. And we've recently reached a deal to be able to show more of those guns, potentially bring some of those guns to the U.S. But there's a rich history here. We're just trying to figure out between Switzerland and the U.S., how do we get more of that history out in the public eye so people who really appreciate the history of guns and the history of SIG can see more of that.
You had Logan at muskets.
That's awesome. Yeah, pretty much. You know, my to-do list is growing. I've got to join the Legion. I got to book a flight to get up to New Hampshire. And then I got to see if I know a guy who can get me in somewhere in Switzerland.
You may know people that can get you in there. But it's cool. When you walk in the museum, there's actually a bell from the original bell tower of the old factory. And it's dated 1853 when they opened the doors of that building. So there's a little stand that's got this bell that had hung in a tower. And then it's underneath it, it's got the original ledger from the opening of the company, if you will, the financial ledger. And it's dated 1853 in this ledger that's about this thick. So and it goes on from
there.
So I mean,
cool.
It's absolutely phenomenal. When Eddie retired, and I would say, Dave, Eddie's probably in the top 3 to 5 gun engineers in the history of the industry, right there with John Browning and Mr. Kalashnikov. One of the most fascinating things to me was when Eddie retired. He's 93 now. Kalashnikov came to his retirement party. So there's a picture of Eddie and Kalashnikov shaking hands in their old suits at this retirement party in Switzerland. So a lot of respect.
That's amazing.
A lot of really, really cool stuff in that facility in Switzerland. So yeah, between the two collections, what Dave has been the protector of stuff here in America, thank goodness for Dave being the bulldog that he is to protect what he's been able to protect. And then going back all the way to the early beginnings of the company in 1853, having all that preserved. We don't have a tremendous amount of bandwidth for the stuff from J.P. Sauer & Sons from the 1750s and beyond. But certainly at the Switzerland branch of the company, it's been very well preserved. And then what we have here in the U.S.
That's amazing. Well, guys, we could sit here and gun nerd out for hours and hours, but we do have to wrap it up a little bit. So I really do appreciate, Dave, Tom, appreciate you guys taking some time out of your day to talk with us about the history of SIG and, you know, not just the 40th anniversary, but the hundreds of years of rich history that the company has.
It's been my pleasure. Enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, it's been great. Hopefully we can do it again on another subject.
You've got a few to choose from.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I think the odds are good, Dave.
Tom will tell you, I got a couple of cross projects that we probably need to talk about.
Very cool. Well, stay tuned, everybody, right? Awesome. Well, again, Dave, Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to all of you who have tuned into this episode. We appreciate you watching and listening. Make sure you're subscribed. Leave us some reviews and comments. Share it with someone you think might enjoy it. We really appreciate you being here, and we'll see you right here on the next episode of the No Low Ballers Podcast.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.